Blog Talk Radio.
Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me is my dear friend and co-host, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre.
Hi, Paula.
Well, we are continuing again, and I should say also with us is Charles Olivier and Neil Waldrop. Hi, you guys. So glad you could make it again.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Paula. Delighted to be here.
Good morning.
Well, we're in the middle of a wonderful study created by Neil, The Unceasing Campaign of the Master Seraphim. And for those of you who have been following along, welcome back. This has been an incredible couple months here. We started with the government on a neighboring planet, and Neil and Charles hung in here with us for the whole thing, and then now we've done the Seraphic Planetary Government. And we're continuing on with this great study of Neil's The Unceasing Campaign. And I'm going to turn it over to Neil because he's going to be managing the study as we continue on. We're on Section 4 of his paper. And Neil, maybe you can again reiterate where people could find this paper if they want to print it out and read along with us.
Thank you very much, Paula. In the previous week, we went through the first three questions in the study guide. Now, for the benefit of listeners, it really would be helpful to you if you had the study guide in front of you as we are going through the questions, because some of the questions are long and they include quotations. Here is the website where you can download the study guide. It is globalendeavor.net. And the link for the study guide on the Master Seraphim is toward the bottom of the home page. You will find it very easily. Now, the underlying topic, of course, correlates intensely, directly, completely with one of the sections of paper 114, namely section 6. And we will again read that section before we continue our discussion today, because it creates a tone. For those of you who are going to download the study guide, you probably have time to do that while we are reading through section 6 of paper 114 by the chief of Seraphim, who is of course herself a primary subparaphim of paradise. Let's start with the reading of Section 6. I believe, Charles, you are willing to begin.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like you to read from the beginning of the section through the paragraph numbered 4, which pertains to the Angels of Nation Life, and then I will ask someone else to continue. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Well, greetings, everyone. Section
greetings.
Six, the...
Greetings, mm-hmm. Charles. Again. And let me just add before you start that
sure.
I have posted the link on the board to the study aid. If anybody wants to just grab that link for those of you who haven't done so already, you can get the link and print out the study aid. Okay.
Mm-hmm. This is
so, Charles,
title section.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You will go ahead now.
Okay, Doug. All set. Section 6 in paper 114, the Seraphic Planetary Government. Section 6 is the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived in Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 corps of special Seraphim, Seraphington graduates, who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision and are, aside from the overcontrol of the Planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the resident Governor General. These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the resident Governor General, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as the volunteer cabinet of the resident Governor General. As Planetary Chief of Seraphim, I preside over this Council of Seraphic Chiefs, and I am a volunteer Supernathan of the Primary Order, serving on Urantia as the successor of the one-time chief of the angelic hosts of the planet who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia secession. The 12 corps of the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows. Number 1, the Epical Angels. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present corps of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. 2, the Progress Angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet. 3, the Religious Guardians. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of the safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial visions of professed religionists. The corps now functioning on Urantia is the fifth thus to serve. 4, the angels of nation life. These are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia national life. The group now functioning in the overcontrol of international relations is the fourth corps to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men.
Thank you, Charles. Paula, mm-hmm. would you please continue reading through from Seraphic Corps 5 through Seraphic Corps 12 to the end of the list?
Sure. Number 5, the Angels of the Races. Those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia, there are remnants of 9 human races which have commingled and combined into the people of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the Ministry of the Race Commissioners, and the group now on Urantius, the original core assigned to the planet soon after the Day of Pentecost. Number 6, the Angels of the Future. These are the projection angels who forecast a future age and plan for the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation. Number 7, the Angels of Enlightenment. Urantia is now receiving the help of the third corps of seraphim dedicated to the fostering of planetary education. These angels are occupied with mental and moral training as it concerns individuals, families, groups, schools, communities, nations, and whole races. Number 8, the Angels of Health. These are the seraphic ministers assigned to the assistance of those mortal agencies dedicated to the promotion of health and the prevention of disease. The present corps is the sixth group to serve during this dispensation. Number 9, the Home Seraphim. Urantia now enjoys the services of the fifth group of angelic ministers dedicated to the preservation and advancement of the home, the basic institution of human civilization. Number 10, the Angels of Industry. This seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This core has been 7 times changed since the bestowal of Michael. Number 11, the Angels of Diversion. These are the seraphim who foster the values of play, humor, and rest. They seek to uplift man's recreational diversions and thus to promote the more profitable utilization of human leisure. The present core is the third of that order to minister on Urantia. And number 12, the Angels of Superhuman Ministry. These are the angels of the angels, those seraphim who are assigned to the ministry of all other superhuman life on the planet, temporary or permanent. This corps has served since the beginning of the current dispensation.
Thank you, Paula. The concluding four paragraphs talk about how the Master Seraphim operate. Andre, would you please read those paragraphs for us?
By all means. When these groups of Master Seraphim disagree in matters of planetary policy or procedure, their differences are usually composed by the Governor General. But all his rulings are subject to appeal in accordance with the nature and gravity of the issues involved in the disagreement. None of these angelic groups exercise direct or arbitrary control over the domains of their assignment. They cannot fully control the affairs of their respective realms of action, but they can and do so manipulate planetary conditions and so associate circumstances as favorably to influence the spheres of human activity to which they are attached. The Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision utilize many agencies for the prosecution of their mission. They function as ideational clearinghouses, mind focalizers, and project promoters. While unable to inject new and higher conceptions into human minds, they often act to intensify some higher ideal, which has already appeared within a human intellect. But aside from these many means of positive action, the Master Seraphim ensure planetary progress against vital jeopardy through the mobilization, training, and maintenance of the Reserve Corps of Destiny. The chief function of these reservists is to ensure against breakdown of evolutionary progress. They are the provisions which the celestial forces have made against surprise. They are the guarantees against disaster.
Thank you, Andre. Now we will start the continued use of the study guide. I would say very briefly for listeners who perhaps were not able to join us the preceding week, the study guide, it consists of 14 pages of questions and answers. Most of the questions include explanation of general ideas. The study guide is divided into three segments. The first segment called Origin, and it begins on page 1 and runs to the first two paragraphs of page 3. The second section is called History Since Pentecost, which begins on page 3 and concludes on page 8. And then the third and final section is called Destiny During the Current Millennium, which begins on page 8 and runs to the end of the study guide. We therefore concluded our discussion last week of the section called Origin, and we will now start the section called History Since Pentecost. The first question is question number 4, beginning on page 3. It's a very long question, but it concludes with two specific questions that I will ask the participants. So for those of you listening, I will be reading for a while. It will seem that this is just an oration of mine. It is really a rather long question, but I repeat that you would be better off as listeners if you had the material in front of you and could follow as we go along. History Since Pentecost, question 4. The Chief of Seraphim tells us that the 12th Corps of Master Seraphim arrived on Urantia, quote, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth. The Chief of Seraphim, 1257, in the one column edition, paper 114, section 6. They accompanied the first Governor General, who also assumed his responsibilities at the time of Pentecost. On the other hand, the Reserve Corps of Destiny was operating long before then, for in the immediately following section of the same paper, the Chief of Seraphim states, quote, the Urantia Reserve Corps had its largest membership in the days of the Adamites and Andites, steadily declining with the dilution of the violet blood and reaching its low point around the time of Pentecost, since which time Reserve Corps membership has steadily increased. The Chief of Seraphim, page 1258, in the one column edition, the same section, I'm sorry, the succeeding section in paper 114, namely section 7. Although it would be rash to assert that the Master Seraphim refrained from seeking to influence other human beings or to mobilize their energies and insights, the Chief of Seraphim explicitly states that members of the Reserve Corps of Destiny are attached to the 12th Corps of Master Seraphim. Another excerpt from the same section of paper 114. These arrangements, however, were not possible until Pentecost. In addition, it may be useful to recall that until Christ Michael had almost completed his bestowal on Urantia in the human form of Jesus of Nazareth, Caligastia was still the planetary prince, at least in a technical sense. Here, there is an excerpt from paper 53 by Manavandit Melchizedek pertaining to Caligastia. Three paragraphs. Caligastia was recognized by the Son of Man as the technical prince of Urantia up to near the time of his death. Said Jesus, now is the judgment of this world, now shall the prince of this world be cast down. And then still nearer the completion of his life work, he announced, the prince of this world is judged. And it is this same dethroned and discredited prince who was once termed God of Urantia. The last act of Michael before leaving Urantia was to offer mercy to Caligastia and Daligastia, but they spurned his tender proffer. Caligastia, your apostate planetary prince, is still free on Urantia to prosecute his nefarious designs, but he has absolutely no power to enter the minds of men, neither can he draw near to their souls to tempt or corrupt them unless they really desire to be cursed with his wicked presence. Before the bestowal of Michael, these rulers of darkness sought to maintain their authority on Urantia, and they persistently withstood the minor and subordinate celestial personalities. But since the day of Pentecost, this traitorous Caligastia and his equally contemptible associate Daligastia are servile before the divine majesty of the Paradise Thought Adjusters and the protective spirit of truth, the spirit of Michael, which has been poured out upon all flesh. That is the end of the quotation. The author, Manavandit Melchizedek, page 610 in the one-column edition, paper 53, section 8. Resuming the question. Neither the Chief of Seraphim nor any other author of the Urantia book tells us how the Reserve Corps of Destiny was administered before the 12th Corps of Master Seraphim arrived on Urantia immediately after the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth. And in the final analysis, we simply do not know. There are two possibilities that seem to be logical. One, there were already some Master Seraphim serving on Urantia, but significantly fewer, not organized into 12 Corps and not led by a primary Seraphim. Or, two, the planetary government was relying on Seraphim who are native to Nebadon, primarily the planetary helpers whom Melchizedek describes in Section 5 of Paper 39. We have considerable information about one such Seraphim native to Nebadon, Salonia, a planetary helper who advised Adam and Eve in the first garden, and who wrote Papers 73 to 76. Salonia belongs to the first group of planetary helpers, those who are called the Voices of the Garden, as stated by Melchizedek on page 437 of the one-column edition, paper 39, section 5. In paper 74, Salonia describes the work of Adam and Eve in the first garden before the default. She states, quote, "The moment Adam's associates began to work outside the garden, they met the direct and well-planned resistance of Caligastia and Dalagastia. The fallen prince was still present on Earth and able, at least to some extent, to resist all of Adam's plans for the rehabilitation of human society." Salonia, page 833 in the one-column edition, paper 74, section 5. In contrast, the narrative that Mount Avendit Melchizedek supplies in paper 53, as cited above, tends to imply that the current work of the Master Seraphim is not impeded and perhaps not even affected by the covert opposition of Caligastia. Subquestion A. During the approximately 35,000 years that elapsed between the default of Adam and Eve and the bestowal of Christ Michael, what strategies could the planetary government adopt in order to reduce and, if possible, overcome interference by Caligastia and Dalagastia? Who would like to give views on that part of the question?
Well, a couple of thoughts that I have on that is as follows. First of all, the Melchizedek receivership was revived. So some form of command authority was necessary to compensate for some of the consequences of the Adamic default. Adam and Eve essentially were an executive authority on a planetary scale, so when they defaulted, that collapsed. And I view the Melchizedek receivership as an emergency action of a sort. And then secondly, another thought I had is that between the coming of Michael and the fault of Adam and Eve and the coming of Michael, human spirituality may have been weakened. And I base that on the necessity for one of the Melchizedeks, Machaventi, to institute a third planetary revelation in order to ensure that the concept of the Father would be retained in human culture. And this would have both a direct and indirect effect of stymieing the influence of the dark powers.
Was that a comment, Andre, or just a hmm?
That was a hmm, not a comment directly, but it does provoke thought. You know, I'm very glad to hear, you know, Charles' elaboration. As I thought about the question, it's a very, very interesting question.
It is.
And one that somehow, you know, I have to admit, was very difficult for me to get my mind around as I
yeah.
pre-thought on this, because I think, you know, I guess I hadn't really considered that aspect of how they might be functioning, that they actually would be maneuvering in various ways, and strategically planning potentially, and I'm not disagreeing with that idea at all, but I really hadn't considered how they might actually be doing that, and part of that might be because of how the rebellion is handled when they talk about the rebellion, and how clear they are about saying that at the onset of the rebellion they were focused entirely on allowing people to come to their own opinions. There really was not any kind of maneuvering or persuasion, and to take the word out of the title of this study, campaign, there, while Gabriel was certainly presenting his point of view on what was going on, and there were those that were, I'm sure, also assisting in that discussion, I don't know that it would have taken the form of a campaign other than to state what were believed or what should have been or what ought to have been obvious truths. However, it's an interesting idea to consider that once all personalities had made their decisions, planning had to take all of that into account. And so I'm intrigued with the question, mainly from the standpoint of first setting a almost like a foundational pedagogy, some thoughts for how we ought to think about this. Because I honestly don't think a lot of people have given many of those aspects of the impact of the rebellion that kind of thought. The fact that I do think this. Let me just say this. I do think they had to think all the while about what was not available to them as a result of active cooperation of a planetary prince. So rather than thinking of the thwarting so much, in the first place, they had to be aware of just how little infrastructure, spiritual infrastructure, was available to them in the process of trying to create what they're doing. When we hear, and I'm fascinated every time we reread that section on the Seraphim of the Future and that whole core. And when we think about the fact that even though there may not have been Master Seraphim, or there may have been, but there certainly that organization came on at Pentecost, the reserve corps that would have been there at that time, assisting the any Seraphim of the Future at that point, would have been assisting those that think architecturally, they use that word, architecturally, about how they need to actually design the successive eras. I find that idea fascinating, the idea that you can plan and design for the outworking and the evolution of an era. And I have to think of that particular core of Seraphim, whether or not they were led by a Master Seraphim at that time, with their associated reserve corps, as having been particularly active somehow. And yet I'm mystified at thinking exactly how. But clearly this would have been one thing. They did have to think about the fact that they didn't have necessary infrastructure, that they had to navigate the world without a lot of help. And then that added feature, which I hadn't really considered quite as much, the idea that at every turn they might be thwarted, and what might they do to not only overcome thwarting, but to diminish its influence. It's a fascinating idea, and I'm still thinking about it.
Thank you, Andre. I would like just to clarify one point that you made earlier. When you started talking, you described the progress of the rebellion and stated that Gabriel had to wait for each person to make a decision, which you meant was spiritual persons in the higher plane. This was not
yes.
a question. Right. Okay. And then the issue of what they did in the intervening time is indeed very interesting. We are speculating, of course. And the question
yes,
allows us to speculate. We have every right to do that. Paula, did you want to join in the speculation?
Well, yeah. You know, something occurs to me, and it's something that Charles said about the Melchizedek receivers, and I just think it's so important. And I'm looking at paper 93, Machiaventa Melchizedek, and 93, section 1, paragraph 2 says, the 12 Melchizedek receivers knew of Michael's impending bestowal on their planet, but they did not know how soon it would occur. Therefore, they convened in solemn council and petitioned the Most Highs of Edentia that some provision be made for maintaining the light of truth on Urantia. This plea was dismissed with the mandate that the conduct of affairs on 606 of Satania is fully in the hands of the Melchizedek custodians. The receivers then appealed to the Father Melchizedek for help, but only received word that they should continue to uphold truth in the manner of their own election until the arrival of the bestowal son, who, quote, would rescue the planetary titles from forfeiture and uncertainty, end quote. Then it goes on to say in the next paragraph, and it was in consequence of having been thrown so completely on their own resources that Machiaventa Melchizedek and the 12 planetary receivers volunteered to do that which has been done only 6 times in the history of Nebadon, to personalize on Earth as a temporary man of the realm, to bestow himself as an emergency son of world ministry. Permission was granted for this adventure by the Salington authorities, and the actual incarnation of Machiaventa Melchizedek was consummated near what was to become the city of Salem in Palestine. I'll stop there. To me, that really shows that the situation was pretty dire, increasingly dire. And
yeah.
they took some strong measures to ensure the light of truth on this planet. So, you know, that's kind of what stumps me about your question. I mean, I don't know that they were able to do much at all.
Hmm.
And this indicates to me that they that coming towards, I mean, just 2,000 years out, and we're talking about 35,000 years, right? And just 2,000 years out from the bestowal of Jesus, Christ Michael, they took some serious action, and they jumped in. And they touched the planet directly, absolutely directly. I mean, they couldn't have made a more direct contact than that, than to appear in material form and start to do some work right there where the rubber meets the road.
Paula, you've made a number of very interesting comments. I would like to turn your comments back and ask you for your views as to why the superiors of the Melchizedek receivers told them to get on with it. It was their responsibility instead of helping them.
Well, now
why,
we really
why
are
weren't they given any help? What was the reason here? Or at least, again, we're speculating. But why do you think they were told that they were the people responsible for this and they should simply do what they thought best?
I guess because they were the best ones to do it. They were closest to the issue. I mean, that's a great question. I haven't really given it any thought. But right off the top of my head, I would say because they were the best ones to do it. They had a handle on it, and they were close to the problem.
Now that I have given some thought, and I agree with Paula on that count, that's number one. You know, they had been assigned responsibility for that, and so an interesting feature of the revelation is what it actually reveals. Sometimes indirectly like this. And one of the things that it reveals is that once responsibility is assigned, there is a great deal of trust once trust has been delegated. So to me, that's number one. But there are other things to remember here in the context of all the revelation that has come before, if one has you know, pursued the revelation, you know, sequentially, I'll just put in a plug. I advocate that every reader of the Urantia book should do that at least once in their lifetime. I think that's the Hajj for Urantia book readers, is to do one sequential reading. That's what we're called to do. But getting off that soapbox, what is interesting and what allows you to think about that at that point is that it's been revealed to you by now that the Melchizedeks are actually created at a higher level than the Most Highs. The Most Highs are certainly appropriately created to do the work that they do. They are the best suited to do that kind of group rulership. But the Melchizedeks are emergency sons and are created at a spiritual level slightly above that of the Most High. So you can imagine the Most High is being appealed to for what essentially was a spiritual emergency. And you can almost hear between the lines, if they were sounding like Urantians in the 21st century, they might sound something like this. Hello? Who are the spiritual emergency sons here? you know? How about it? So, but that brings up the curious point, which is also revelatory, of the humility of the Melchizedek receivers in actually asking for direction. They may have had plenty of ideas, but before going out and embarking on that, these higher spiritual beings do not assume any authority. They first go to the Most Highs, and they ask the Most Highs what they ought to do. They're then told by the Most Highs, listen, you guys are in charge. You do what you think is best. Then they go to their father. They go to their father, Melchizedek, and ask him for what they ought to do. And like a good father that trusts his good sons, he says, You are on your own recognizance. I trust that you'll do the right thing. Do what a Melchizedek would do, is what I read between the lines, what I hear as the subtext there. And so they have all kinds of things that they could do, and it's a rare thing, this sort of intrusion into the stream of affairs and human affairs, and they don't take it lightly, is what I read there. But the third thing that comes to mind with regard to that is that a Melchizedek not only doesn't take it lightly, but it's not taken lightly by anybody else that they should assume or presume that any Melchizedek ought to bestow. You don't hear anybody saying, well, I think you ought to bestow yourself, Malcaventa. go for it. I think that has to be an entirely personal choice because of the gravity, because of all the implications that we're certainly unaware of. To do so involves the secrets of Sanarrington again. And even though it's not a Michael bestowal, it still is a bestowal. And he becomes just like a magisterial son on that kind of bestowal. Not just like one in nature, but it's effectively the same kind of process. Being born, or created fully as an adult in adult form, and then interacting with human beings and all the responsibilities and implications that are there. I think that as a result of that, everybody takes this as a solemn choice, and I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Thank you, Andrea. I would like to probe just a bit farther in terms of the moral lesson involved in this narrative that Paula introduced us to. It seems to me that there is a contrast implicitly with the tendency that perhaps is present fairly often in human events to appeal to higher authority to solve one's problems. Is there an implicit contrast in terms of what happened with the Melchizedek receivers? Should we be asking for a thunderbolt to descend from heaven and suddenly remodel human society?
Well, remember, I wouldn't compare it. I think it's a contrast to human foibles and human vulnerabilities. Remember, this Urantia had experienced two abject failures in executive authority, planetary executive authority, with many dire consequences, many, from biological to spiritual to moral, etc. And it seems to me the Melchizedek receivership was gathering what we call group wisdom. Now, group wisdom of 12 Melchizedeks must be formidable, but they're also humble, not weak, but humble and modest. And given the bad precedents established, and apparently I infer that the planetary prince was doing his best to undermine the father concept, we call monotheism, the idea of the universal father, because Lucifer Rebellion was atheistic originally. It denied the existence of the universal father, the existence of God. I assume that Caligasti and Deligasti agreed with that and supported that, although their reasoning escapes me. But notwithstanding, the Melchizedeks had to deal with a growing and grim spiritual problem and a moral problem. Remember the third epical revelation, or the Salem teachers, included essentially commandments, moral commandments as well. They were addressing that business. But the principle, of course, was the existence of God, the notion that we're not alone, that there is a Father, there is something at the center, and He has a relationship with us, and we have a relationship with Him. The book makes it very clear that he never lost sight of the ball, to use a baseball metaphor. So I think group wisdom was responsible for, one, their appeal on high, and in the circumstances that they found themselves. And two, I think either Machiavelli was selected by the other 11, or he volunteered for it. But I'm sure it was a combination of something about, my guess is a combination of both, that he was willing to do it. One of them had to do it and go physical, as it were. Or at least appear to go physical, and then actually do this and reestablish the notion of God in one of the cultures, to anticipating Michael's birth bestowal. And Michael had to come, and he couldn't teach about the Father unless the culture had a concept of the Father, which implies that the traitorous planetary prince who was doing all he could to harm the future of this world, and the best way to do that is to separate the child from the parent. If you want to maximize damage to a species, a human species, a mortal species, then as much as possible, you would want to separate those individuals, those groups, from God. And the stakes apparently were that high, given the evidence of the third epical revelation.
Thank you, Charles. To make things even more complicated, I'd like to point out that from what we understand through much of this period and perhaps the entire 35,000 years, there were also present on Urantia not only Caligasti and Deligasti, but rebel midwayers and rebel angels.
Mm-hmm.
What we have been told is that both of these groups of rebels were interned. And I believe there is a statement that they were interned, or at least some of them were interned at the time of Pentecost. But in the period that we're talking about, they weren't. And they must have been very damaging and mischievous, one would think, in terms of resisting the efforts of the Melchizedek receivers and their associates to bring about a positive spiritual progression on our planet.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone want to talk about that?
I would like just briefly. It must have been, I'm very sympathetic to the loyal angels trying to deal with this, with the presence of disloyal fellows, disloyal sisters. And on top of that, the reserve corps would have been greatly stressed by these rebel angels in midwaves as well. So that whole system, that insurance system, must have really been tested. They must have had a very difficult time dealing with these internal betrayals and contradictions. At the same time, they had a responsibility to help the human race.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
I
think
love
we've
those
done
points that Charles is bringing up. I think mm-hmm. those are remarkable points. The idea that the one thing and the fact that I think Charles speaks for many who are either naturally or have come to a theistic viewpoint, it's difficult to imagine how that atheistic viewpoint is reasoned out to someone who has never really known an atheistic viewpoint. I grew up, you know, never really knowing an atheistic viewpoint. I may have doubted myself plenty in life, which is a form of doubting God. But I certainly haven't doubted God directly. Thought he knew what he was doing well, just maybe didn't quite know what he was doing when he put me on the planet at times earlier on in my career, which is just as bad as you know, doubting God for any other reason. But the idea here is this: I have trouble understanding, you know, these kinds of intellects actively thwarting and how they might actively thwart. Because were they more antagonists to the idea of the Father, or were they more proponents of this idea of liberty at all costs? It's really hard for me to get my head around that completely, and I think there are gaps in my ability to fully imagine that. Probably a good deal of that will have to be revealed to me in the next life, you know, in terms of actual history. But I think about it, aside from what I might learn from some of my fellows here, and I think that's my other soapbox, is that's why I find study groups so valuable. You get so many other points of view that you could never come up with entirely on your own. I really look forward to hearing some of your ideas on this, because I can see them more as being proponents of this idea of false liberty, which they would regard as true liberty, that you ought to be able to go forward without any view as to how things need to evolve step by step, and that giving people freedom right away is a really good idea, this idea of self-assertion. And so that would have been something that the reservists and the government at the time and the Melchizedek receivers would have been functioning in that kind of an environment. But I do believe that this idea of antagonism toward the Father idea was also there. I just can't quite envision how. So I look forward to hearing your ideas on that.
Thank you, Andre, but I believe that it is my role as the moderator to draw answers out of you guys, and that I should basically stand back. But there is one point that I would like to probe in addition on. The scenario that all of us have been discussing involves a balance of influence that is different from the situation that obtains now. And we have discussed in many regards that the resources available to the opposition, which Charles called the dark side, were different. And I'm wondering now if, in effect, the current conception of humanity, that good and evil are of equal power, and that the bad guys, the dark side, are just as strong as the favorable spiritual influences, really comes from this earlier period in which the dark side was more actively present in the world than is the case now. What do people think of that?
Well, Paula, do you want to speak?
Well, my question here has to do with the current consciousness of human beings, which includes some people's view that good and evil are approximately equal, that the influence of the dark side is just about as strong as the influence of God and his loyal servants. And I'm wondering if that psychology of approximate equal of good and evil actually descends from this earlier period.
Neil, I'll quickly weigh in and say I think that's an excellent leading question.
Okay.
And I will agree with you. I think that definitely happened, but I'll back off at present because I'm interested in what Paula and Charles have to say on elaborating on that, because I have trouble really understanding intelligent beings prosecuting this kind of an aim. It's just beyond me how it wouldn't be more subtle than this, and yet clearly the results that we have in front of us, that those kinds of attitudes are prevalent throughout the entire world, clearly there's merit to that idea.
Well, and I just want to add, too, that, you know, the time frame involved, when we're talking about so many thousands of years of darkness, and you're wondering, a person might say, well, you know, I think, Andre, you said earlier, well, you know, you question God, or you question, you people look around and they see the condition of the world, whatever moment in time they're living in down here, let's face it. Conditions are not ideal. And you don't have to be extremely bright to figure that out. You just listen to the news, and before you had news, you just looked at the, you know, I mean, 300 years ago, you just looked at the way that you had to eke out a living and somehow try to survive. And I'm sure thinking people have said often, you know, if God's real, why are the conditions down here so dire, so terrible? Why are humans so horrible to each other? I've had atheists ask me this to my face. And, you know, I think that ultimately the whole thing is about the outworking of a plan that is a long-term plan. And we don't have a concept of long-term. We think 50 years is long-term. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to work out from the moment Jesus announced he was coming here to, you know, to 35,000 years later, he's here. That's long-term. And you know, when he was here, he said, I'm here, I'm making a beginning of setting these things straight. And we can see that, you know, things have sped up since then a lot, and we're going to talk about Pentecost, and that's great. So I think the difficulty is the time frame that we're looking at. They have a long, they meaning the Melchizedek receivers and the Most Highs and all of them in the universe of universes, they have a long-term perspective. They know that God's plan will win. We don't know that. And so we are very vulnerable in our little place and time to the planning of a suggestion that makes us impatient, as what happened to Eve proves. And she even had a long-term perspective compared to us. But once she was down here on this most difficult planet, they were able to, that the sophistry was to wheedle away at her impatience to make a difference now. And that's the trickiest part for us humans, I think. Because we want to do something now. We want to see a change in our lifetimes. And we may not. We may not. We may, and we may not. And that's just the reality. That is the test of our faith, I think.
Excellent. Yeah. I just love what... I think your example of Eve underscores that idea of, you know, the wheedling away, and not only that, but the idea that that could also just fall under there being proponents of the idea of liberty now.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of any atheistic dimension there, that's an example of that. But I think the atheistic dimension is there too, and I suspect Charles has a lot of ideas. I can almost hear him. I can almost hear him just ready to jump in.
I can hear him thinking.
thank you both. I would like to respond to Neil's question first, and then your inquiry, your extended inquiry, Andre. It's a very serious inquiry, a very serious point you've raised. Neil, I think very, very likely human alienation now and in the past may have taken origin, or has certainly been seeded, S-E-E-D-E-D, seeded at that time, this time period between Michael and the Adamic default. And in human alienation, faith tends to shrivel, to shrink. It's difficult of somebody who's alienated, that is, they're alone, they have a sense of being alone, they're not connected, they're so a desperation to grow. Thoreau put it this way, that in many men's minds, many men's hearts, there is a quiet desperation that they live with. And many of our myths we know are traceable for the origins of those myths go back thousands of years. I think it's a very plausible, Neil, a very plausible hypothesis. I never thought of it before, that this time frame of approximately 35,000 years and all the suffering and alienation that occurred, requiring an emergency planetary revelation, happened and influenced and shaped human thoughts and our fears. And our animal nature, our animal origins would tend to encourage us to give in to those fears. And I use the word alienation to sort of summarize all of that. It's regrettable, and it's something, the only real antidote is the love of God to human alienation. It's only God's love that can successfully obliterate it, to destroy it. Jesus said, "We come to destroy the sin, not just, and to heal." Love is greater than courage in that it fears not, but it also heals that courage really can't do. But love has the power to not count the cost or to be courageous, to obliterate fear. At the same time, it can heal. And hence the importance of the religion of the spirit, the importance of the spiritual consciousness that our master lived and taught us. On your question, Andre, concerning your inquiry concerning the angelic in Midway, the loyal angels in Midway is trying to deal with this, and how the disloyal ones arrived at it is certainly problematic and very troubling. It seems to me, I'm sympathetic, though, to the disloyal angels. I'm not sympathetic to Caligastia and Deligastia, because I believe, and I'll explain in a moment why. But I am sympathetic generally to the angels and generally the midwayers, notwithstanding what they did. They were essentially sheep, in a way, sheep-like.
Mm-hmm.
They were followers. And they probably had never encountered in their existence fraud. Now, there are two problems here. There's delusion, not illusion, delusion and fraud. My guess is that their belief in the pitch that the planetary press gave them with regard to false liberty was probably deluded them. And given his sure clever wiles, et cetera, and the help they may have had from Satan, so forth. But the false liberty ideology, I believe, from the standpoint of those who are the authors of it, were fraudulent. In other words, they knew what they were doing.
Mm.
They were not deluded. They were iniquitous in that sense. They had repeatedly separated us from God. They had repeatedly disrespected Michael's authority, and so forth. They did this deliberately, willfully, not arbitrarily. It wasn't a mistake.
Mm.
It was deliberately done to harm and to hurt Michael's authority and the well-being of the universe and the universe view and the world view, and most of all to come between God and his children, or try to come between God and his children, at least in the minds of his children. And the angels and midwayers, two more observations on that. The disloyal angels and midwayers, I suspect, had no guile. I mean, they weren't equipped to deal with such a moral and spiritual catastrophe. There's nothing in their experience. They may have historically been aware of other rebellions, but that's intellectual. That's at a distance. That's not emotional.
Yeah.
They have feelings. That's not in your face. This was in their face, as we say. The loyal ones, at the same time, paralleling all this, trying to deal with their sisters who had betrayed, and a lot of midwayers, the majority of midwayers are lost. It must have been very hard in the midwayers, the loyal ones. They had a dual problem. They had to deal with the failure of their fellows on the one hand, and then they had to deal with what they were assigned to do, their responsibilities. And in all this, there was no single executive authority. There was no Adam available. And Eve, and they had a group of Melchizedeks functioning both legislatively and executively, and it must have been all they could do to hold on, and to deal with their state of mind, the loyal, all the ones who were loyal. But they wouldn't have known fraud. I mean, fraud would have been a terrible thing for them to deal with.
Yeah.
Hello.
What
yes.
was your you're on, Neil?
Oh, okay.
What was your question?
I had a mechanical issue at one point, so thank you for reconnecting me, Paula.
Oh,
I wonder now if perhaps we've adequately explored the terrible difficulties and can now turn to the second half of the question, which is B, how did the situation change after Pentecost? What additional resources became available?
We've already touched on this a little bit in a couple of previous shows, but go ahead, Andre.
Well, no, I mean, there's the foundational answers, but I think we're also interested in getting to some kinds of other ideas. So clearly, you know, Michael leaving the Spirit of Truth, or rather leaving and sending the Spirit of Truth, was the biggest change for everyone, but there was also the fact that really he instituted a new government here, and by all accounts, looking through this paper 114 that your study is based on, primarily, it really appears that this government is one that is primarily looking at fostering spiritual individuality, and I don't mean I don't mean in any kind of egoic kind of a way, but they're really trying to. The fact that former human beings are largely former human beings, with a few exceptions, are being put in positions of power to lead the government on this earth, and to work with angels, and to have angels actually taking their direction from them, is astounding. I don't have much more to say about that.
You're talking about the 24 counselors. And
the 24 counselors that rotate in and out as governors general. So,
and now we have one of them who is present on the spiritual plane of the planet.
Correct.
Hello?
Correct.
Yes.
And so that to me is astounding. But I'll back off from there. Those are the foundational fact answers. I'm interested in what truths people come up with there. I'm going to keep reflecting on this a bit.
You've already mentioned the spirit of truth. What other spiritual resources became available to human beings as individuals?
Well, the thought adjuster is as a result of that, but let me let others, reply further.
Well, in essence, the whole restructuring of the planetary government, all of its various components, and I listed five, 4 and 20 counselors, the spirit of truth, which is indirectly involved, the flooding of the universal presence of the Father's Thought Adjusters and Archangel Divisional Headquarters, and the 12 Corps of Master Seraphim led by a Paradise Angel, Paradise Origin Angel, and then the fifth apical revelation, and which comes directly to us. That's right in our hands, literally in our hands, in our laps, that we can read and then act upon.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you reply to the person who, in effect, complained to Paula in the story that she told us that the world is a mess, and how can we believe in a good God if the world is such a terrible place?
Go ahead, Paula.
I think that... and what I told the fellow who told me that, and it was actually a woman, but I've had, several atheists say that to me, and my heart goes out to them. It really does, because I understand why they would ask that question, and maybe they really are seeking for God. My feeling is that God gives us, he delegates all, and this is an understanding that I have. Obviously, everybody doesn't have this understanding of God. I do, because I've read the Urantia book. He delegates everything to his many subordinate creatures. And so it goes all the way down to the human level. He delegates to us, and we do his work. We become his hands. We become his eyes, his ears, his heart on this world. If we don't work to make the world better, it doesn't get better. And that's really what, when they say things like, it's through this reserve corps of destiny that the Most Highs are able to rule in the kingdoms of men, that's what they're getting at. Sooner or later, humanity will evolve. That's the long-distance view. God knows that. Sooner or later, with all of this help we've been given, thought adjusters, the spirit of truth, the reserve, or the angelic corps, all of the 4 and 20 counselors, everything Charles mentioned and Andre mentioned, sooner or later, we will start to come along spiritually, and we will realize that the responsibility to make the world a better place rests directly on us. And that's how God works. God works through us. If the world's, the world won't be a better place until we make it a better place. And that's the beauty of it. And that is what empowers us to be the great and beautiful, benevolent spiritual beings we can be. He wants us to grow, ultimately. It's like a loving father you know, giving his child everything he needs to create something beautiful. He could easily create that beautiful thing for the child and just give it to him. But the child would lose the opportunity, the joy of discovery, the joy of effort, the joy of having been able to create something monumentally beautiful by his own power and by an act of his own will. And God, the God I know, would never rob us of that.
Paula, you are so persuasive that I suppose the person you were speaking with immediately agreed with you, right?
Oh, no. But
I think part of what you said connects very directly with our discussion last week of the comparison between the role of God the Spirit and God the Supreme. The Supreme Being is dependent on us for evolution in terms of the spiritual destiny of this planet. The Supreme Being is not carrying everything out, and we have the role to do that.
Right. And that's the beauty.
Yes.
That's our joy, our spiritual adventure. That's what we get to do. We love to do that, too. Every child loves to learn by doing. You know, any child you'll ever meet, you know, you can build something for him, or you can give him a hammer and nails and some wood and just watch it go to town. You know, obviously he's trying to teach us how to do things right, but and we're trying to learn, and it's no easy thing, but the joy is to learn by doing.
Thank you.
I think it's probably fruitless, Neil, to argue with someone Paula described. However, I once comforted a man who had several weeks to live. He's an atheist all his life, and remained an atheist, and he was going to die in within a couple of months at the longest. And somebody asked me, well, how could you comfort somebody with the love of God who's an atheist? I said, well, I didn't mention God, except when I prayed over him, but I asked permission. We had been friends for about a year, and I use the language of friendship, but I wouldn't argue these points. It's generally not wise and fruitless to approach it intellectually. I'd have to assess the individual in front of me. If he or she was willing to have a quiet conversation on the matter and not a debate, then there might be some possibilities to bring some things forth, particularly in the form of questions. But I think generally I would use the language of friendship, the language of goodwill, of good cheer, and try to manifest the love of God that way.
I agree with everything you just said, Charles. I would add that there is an implicit dimension involving spiritual authority or pretension to spiritual authority, whereby in the past individuals and groups who have been the conservators of certain spiritual truths have used that role in ways that they believed gave them authority over other people. And so part of the argument here has to do with implicitly rejecting someone else's right to tell me or you or anyone else what to do and what to believe. And so I think your tactic of emphasizing positive values and not entertaining an argument is a very insightful approach.
I'll be glad to weigh in a little further. That, you know, I want to pick up on the idea that was expressed a little bit earlier. The idea of atheism having had made its mark on the planet in the form of the Lucifer Rebellion. In fact, it was an atheist movement. So when Paula is talking to a person like that, it's difficult to do this in the context of the Urantia teachings exactly. But for somebody who's open to the Urantia teachings, it is possible to indicate that the fruits of atheism is the kind of destruction and wanton problem that we do see in the world. This is not God's doing. This is the result of an atheistic campaign. This is what you get when you don't have God functioning. And now you do have plenty of, you know, counterarguments to that. You do have, well, look at all the problems with ecclesiastical authority, and look at all of this, and look at all of that. But you know, I would counter at every turn, you know, and I agree with Charles that in a sense that when you argue with people like this, I sort of read between the lines in some of what he was saying, you end up striving with men, as Jesus said, one should not strive with men. One should not, in other words, try to function on that particular level. Rather, try to come from a spiritual point of view and try to meet them where they are, lovingly, with an attitude of love. But the idea being that if there is an argument to be made in the right context, if that is a fruitful kind of venue, then or way of accomplishing something, then what one ought to do is to try to present those aspects of the revelation that essentially the world is the way it is, not because of God or people's misplaced religion, but rather because they don't fully envision the God that is there.
They don't know God.
All authoritarian religion is itself affected by those atheistic points of view, in the sense that they don't fully know God in order to be arguing for a God that's that authoritarian, that doesn't love us so much that, yes, he will lovingly chastise us for our own profit, but he's not the Old Testament God of the Bible, or he's not the, you know, any kind of a vengeful God. He's patient, and he brings us along at our own pace, and sometimes not at our own pace. He'll give us exactly what we need individually, and the more open we are to that, the more likely we are to receive it.
I think that all of you have put forward very interesting points, but as the moderator of this discussion, I believe I should draw it to a close and move on to the next question, because
okay.
We could keep discussing this point probably for the rest of the program, and I believe that I am obliged to cause us to move forward. So let's go on to question 5.
Well
which
done.
Is on, hello. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well done, I said.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Paula. Mm-hmm. Question 5. Based on information that the Chief of Seraphim provides in Section 6 of Paper 114, it would seem that she and the 12 Corps of Master Seraphim are assigned to Urantia for relatively short periods. The following table summarizes the personnel rotations that have occurred from time to time. And here we have a table including the leadership role and then the 12 Corps, and I will read across the table. The Chief of Seraphim, second primary Supernaphim since Pentecost. 1, the Epical Angels, third group since Pentecost. 2, the Progress Angels, second group since Pentecost. 3, the Religious Guardians, fifth group since Pentecost. 4, the Angels of the Races, I'm sorry, number 4, the Angels of Nation Life, the fourth group since Pentecost. 5, the Angels of the Races, first group since Pentecost. 6, the Angels of the Future, first group since Pentecost. 7, the Angels of Enlightenment, third group since Pentecost. 8, the Angels of Health, the sixth group since Pentecost. 9, the Home Seraphim, the fifth group since Pentecost. 10, the Angels of Industry, the seventh group since Pentecost. 11, the Angels of Diversion, the third group since Pentecost. And 12, the Angels of Superhuman Ministry, the first group since Pentecost. How do you analyze the rotational pattern summarized above? In your opinion, what factors influence the timing and frequency of personnel rotations?
It's a wonderful question.
I found this one to be one of the most intriguing questions. Maybe the thought that first came to my mind was the difficulty of the task they faced, and how, for lack of a better word, how burned out maybe they got just trying to do it, that they had to be rotated out, and a fresh group had to come in. That was my first thought, honestly.
The fresh horse theory.
They requested a vacation. Is that it?
Yeah, I think so. But that's just my first, thought.
Who else would like to comment on this question?
I'd be happy to. Two general remarks. One, which I can detail, but I won't unless this time. One would be the relative progress of human ideas, inventions, and movements. And I wrote several examples. The other one, perhaps more significant, I analyze them in terms of the most frequent turnover, the ones that have the most frequent turnover. And I hypothesized from that the following. There are three basic components of civilization: self-maintenance, self-gratification, and self-perpetuation. And that can be projected onto all of humanity, and all of civilization. And that's what I intend with this. And of the 12, the four that had the highest turnover, starting with the one that had the most, would be industry, health, the angels of health, then home and religion. The angels of industry had 7 turnovers, health 6, and home and religion 5 apiece. And the industry deals with essentially work and productivity. Health deals with curing diseases or preventing diseases. The home deals with nurturing, the rearing of children. And religion deals with the soul. And going out on a limb to an extent, I grouped all those four under the heading of self-maintenance. So in response to your question, I think they were responding to all three, maintenance, gratification, and perpetuation. But I think given the manifold difficulties of humanity in the last 2,000 years and the tremendous tensions that have been created by progress itself, particularly material progress, but insufficiency of moral and spiritual progress, those tremendous tensions that seem to come to a head in the 20th century and then the 21st century, that self-maintenance was the priority for them over perpetuation, that maintenance of civilization was the priority over perpetuation and gratification. Not that those were ignored, they were not, but maintenance, just maintaining us, was itself a tremendous challenge. That's what I thought.
Thank you. I would like to offer an additional perspective. I agree with everything that Charles said, but let's look at this from one other point of view. The various corps of Master Seraphim are being assigned. From the perspective of the assignment process, what is signified by the rotations?
What is signified?
Why does the senior authority, perhaps Gabriel or something, someone or group on the level of Gabriel, decide that a particular corps of Master Seraphim should be rotated? Paula said that they got tired, and the Master Seraphim got tired in effect and needed a break. But I'd like to look from the other side.
Uh-huh.
Why would the superior level, which is responsible for assigning the various corps of Master Seraphim, decide to rotate personnel?
Well, as we change, they change. because we change, they change. We've had in 2,000 years tremendous, what historians call lines of force, both particularly in Eastern and Western civilizations, especially in the West. The Renaissance, we had the Age of Exploration the last 500 years, which for the first time actually covered the whole planet. Although China got as far as East Africa, but it was came out of the Europeans to conquer the world and explore it and map it and all that. Those are these. That's a tremendous change in knowledge, human knowledge. The emergence of the nation-state system, it reordered the international power political system. The emergence of modern science, particularly medical science, economics, modern democracy and other kinds of modern political forces. The printing press, the telegraph. The telegraph, for the first time in human history, showed people that you could send intelligence over time and space almost instantaneously. Yeah, that had to alter human consciousness and therefore the potentials and possibilities what humans could be led to do. The Industrial Revolution altered the whole nature of society, wherever it's been implanted. The spread of monotheistic religion. In the last 2,000 years, today, approximately half the human race is monotheistic, particularly Sikhs, Jews, Muslims, Christians, which is remarkable. That's a phenomenal advance. So I think as we changed, they had to change from the point of view of their superiors.
I'd like to go back to a comment that Andre and I discussed last week, and that is that the angels are following orders. Now, again, without trying to answer my own question, and I will try to avoid doing that, they have been given orders. Is there a process in which these orders might change as part of the rotation?
Well, that's certainly a definite possibility there. It is also possible. I do like the idea of the idea that each core is like a working group that is. I mean, clearly there. I don't envision them all of a sudden saying, "Okay, now you're done. Let's quickly assemble a new core." These other next core, for instance, say of the Angels of Industry, are waiting in the wings. They're already anticipating what that next era is. In fact, the Seraphim of the future are envisioning some of those eras. So there's planning and master planning and everything else going on, and so you can bet that just like there's a batter in the box, when there's a batter at the plate, you have these core practicing in the wings, shadowing and working through what they might be doing, getting ready to take their place. So I definitely see that as being part of it. I also do see that orders possibly can change. It also can be that you know, who knows that when the Most High Observer becomes the Most High Regent, some of that may have to do with mandating a change, saying that we really are at the end of this place here, this particular juncture, and maybe it's better to change right now, just given this new twist that humanity has taken. That's all speculative, but you know, the bottom line, I envision. I think what part of what we're being given here is a window on the eras of human evolution with regard to some very significant developments, and that includes, you know, the home, industry, health, all of that. I think in some ways we could be encouraged to look for these markers. The other thing that strikes me with that is that these cores of angel are not necessarily changing when an era changes. They may be changing well in advance of the era that changes. They may have accomplished the task that now it's clear that we're about to go into an era change, maybe 50 to 100 to 200 years down the road. It may be clear that they've accomplished what they needed to accomplish in order to get us there, and evolution is proceeding just the way it should. So the next core comes in and is actually functioning ahead of time, kind of like turning a huge oil tanker in the sea. You start making the turn or you start slowing down long before you get to the harbor or long before you course correct, long before you've achieved that goal. So in anticipation.
You know,
go ahead.
It may just be, too, an exertion issue. An issue of, you know, like you mentioned somebody in the batter's box, or I think of, you know, my daughter played basketball, and the coach would rotate out the players to keep them fresh and strong because they're exerting themselves. So you see these tasks that require more focus, more intensity, and I take your point so well, Andre, you know, the efforts required to start to turn that around. This is where the rubber really meets the road. So you've got to keep that exertion level up at such an intensity that they have to rotate them out. I tend to look at it or try to see it from a logistical point of view, because I think a lot of what they do is just pure logistics.
Well, logistics in the sense of preparing human beings for the decisions and changes that we need to make. That really is what you mean, yes. It's not logistics in a mechanical sense, right?
No, I mean, but I guess you could compare it to that. I mean, they have to deal with problems, you know, in the same way that we have to deal with problems. I mean, problems are problems. And to me, logistics is how you solve problems. So.
Well, that's certainly a very important dimension of this. I will now yield to the temptation, finally, to give a view of my own. My background included 27 years in the diplomatic service of the United States, and the reality of a diplomat includes the idea that when you start off in your capital, you have the view of your home country, and then you arrive at the embassy where you're going to be assigned, and at first you're very strong with the views of your home country, but then you get to know the people in the country where you're working. And you become affected by their attitudes and beliefs. And after a year or two, you start being better at explaining the country where you're living to the government in your capital than you are at explaining your capital to the people of the country. So what I'm trying to say, I think, is that after a while, there is a natural tendency to lose emphasis or to lose enthusiasm for the task, or if you wish to apply the point of view of computer programming, they need to bring on a new group who have been programmed differently and who are going to proceed in the new directions, whereas perhaps the energies and attitudes of the group in place have reached their logical conclusion. And I offer this just as a possibility. I think that the various dimensions of the answer that everyone has contributed are all valid.
I like that. Thank you.
Good.
That's a nice
perspective. I'm happy in this case to be able to contribute in ways that make sense to the rest of you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this point before we go on to the next question?
Yeah, actually, I don't think we've exhausted this yet. And,
okay,
and
go ahead.
There's some interesting aspects to exploring that idea and some of the others, both the exertion question on the one hand, and which is one facet of being in a place. I'm sure you've seen in specifically pretty tense kinds of situations where a particular core of diplomats is fatigued, you know, if things are pretty bad. that would be one aspect. And then the other, where there's such a tendency to take on the point of view that at that point there needs to be a little more distancing in order to bring on, if I hear you correctly, bring on people that can more freshly express the point of view of the country that they're representing.
And Andre, there's also an aspect that we haven't even covered, and that is the thought, and several people on the board have mentioned this now, this thought that the experience that the angels have, the benefit of the experience that they're getting, and perhaps there's also desire to give more angels the opportunity to experience it. So I just wanted to throw that in there too.
I think that's true too, yeah. Let me offer a little bit of counter-argumentation here, because what that does is it explains the frequent changes somewhat. What it doesn't explain at all is the ones that haven't changed at all. You know, are we saying, are we arguing, and I'll put it more as a question, are we saying that the angels of the future and the angels of superhuman ministry have a plum job? And it's much easier for them to function. And I deliberately left the last group, group five, the angels of the races, out of the question. The angels of the races on this planet have a plum job trying to compose nine races here and get them all functioning individually and severally and you know, together.
Are you going to answer
forward?
Your own question now, Andre?
Is it rhetorical?
I suppose I've posed a bit of a leading question there myself, haven't I? You caught me. The point is that there is that aspect of this assignment, of this being assigned. The angels of the future, of course, you can more easily see why it might be the same group, because they are holding the long term view, and they could be sort of the metacognitive thinkers here, if you will. They're the ones who are the project of the project. They are trying to keep the wide and the long view for everyone, and seeing things. So they may actually function as some kind of directors. The angels of superhuman ministry can't fully explain that, but it may be that there isn't such a change of superhuman personnel on the planet that it would necessitate a very different kind of a mission. So I'm thinking of this more as different kinds of missions. And just before I let go of that and hear what your ideas are on that, I do want to point out something very curious, and see what your thoughts are on this. You know, they refer in all 12 of these groups, they use ordinal numbers for all but one of them. They for groups, you know, 1 through 9, 11 and 12, they all pose ordinal numbers, but curiously, they play with how human beings are very bad at switching in their thinking from ordinal to cardinal numbers. And they say this very, very interestingly for the angels of industry. The seraphic group is concerned with fostering industrial development and improving economic conditions among the Urantia peoples. This core has been 7 times changed since the bestowal of Michael. Now, you might read that the initial group could count as the first change, but we're told that this regime really only came into being at the beginning. So would you consider the first group as really being a change? Is it that they're really saying that, in fact, we are now under the eighth core of the angels of industry. Mm. And might their reason, well, I could suggest a reason here. I could do another leading question, but what are your thoughts here on why that may be?
If perhaps I can be excused for giving my own opinion here, I think that your interpretation is an interesting one, but there is an alternate view which would say that the change from zero to one is already a change. In other words, it is possible to read this either way, and
yeah.
I would look at the numbers and the wording as simply an effort to maintain variety of expression, at least that being a possibility. Does anyone else want to react to Andre's question?
Well, I think the I have a more linear view of that, Andre.
Okay.
They established the 12 simultaneously, timed it deliberately
mm-hmm.
with Pentecost, the coming of the Spirit of Truth, and collaborated and coordinated with the Spirit of Truth. And I believe the basis of rotation has two criteria, to serve and those whom are served, who are served, to serve and those that are served. As a teacher, I had two types of goals, student goals and teacher goals, but my teacher goals were on behalf of the students, not on my behalf. My behavior was directed toward what I thought were their needs and wants, legitimate needs and wants. And my judgments were built around that criteria and then their needs and wants in terms of what their deficiencies and so forth might have been, and secondly, how I wanted to bring them up. I think they don't get tired or anything. I think it's rather they're motivated to serve, and they're motivated by those to whom they work with and serve. And I think the changes essentially are what I said earlier, that as we changed, our needs and wants changed, so hence they would change would have angels who would be trained differently. Not that they're not all skilled, generally speaking, but they'd be trained differently for a planet in rebellion that had special needs, particular special requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But at an earlier stage, Charles commented on the many changes in humanity, the different levels of civilization and society that have occurred in the last 2,000 years. And I would like to use that theme as a way perhaps of returning to this question of frequency of rotation. Most of these examples of changes that Charles mentioned earlier had to do with the high priority groups of seraphim that have been changed frequently. I mean high priority in terms of
mm-hmm.
the frequency of changes, not that their tasks are a level of higher importance. So in industry, the champion here, it is clear that the conditions of economic life have changed dramatically in the 2,000 years since Pentecost, and that these
mm-hmm.
changes have occurred repeatedly. Now, that is likely also to be the case of the techniques involved in health, maintaining health. We know that science has dramatically changed the approaches to medicine that have been adopted in the past several hundred years, for example. Now, if we take this as at least a thought process that we can apply, then look at the cases where there has not been a change in 2,000 years. Seraphic Corps 5, the Angels of the Races, Seraphic Corps 6, the Angels of the Future, and Seraphic Corps 12, the Angels of Superhuman Ministry. The last one is the easiest, at least in my opinion, to analyze,
mm-hmm.
the Angels of Superhuman Ministry. Their tasks haven't changed. The angels
mm.
haven't changed. The ministry functions that they're providing are the same. At least it is very logical to postulate that. I am still agreeing that we are speculating on all of these regards, and so that is a speculation in my point. But if we go back to the Angels of the Races and the Angels of the Future, numbers 5 and 6, it is at least worth considering whether the fundamental dimensions of the task are largely the same as they were 2,000 years ago.
Well, that's
my take. Another way of saying that the principles of the angels of the races that were valid then remain valid now.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier, Andre mentioned that the future is the future. One could look upon the tasks of this core of Master Seraphim as pertaining to perhaps the next dispensation or the next period of human life, whatever one will say. And perhaps those functions are largely constant because they are preparing for a future which itself is being developed over time.
Right.
Now, having given these thoughts, I certainly don't wish to insist that my answer is the right one, and I would yield the floor to anyone who would like to comment either in the same direction or perhaps in a contrasting direction.
Well, I just want to add something that I think is, you know, I don't know, fundamental to my thinking on this. And that is that angels are far from perfect. And they're very close to us, which is why they are so vital to our planetary administration. Of course, these are super angels, aren't they?
They've been all the way to Seraphic.
Yeah, they're pretty special angels.
They're very able.
Yeah, very, very able. So, you know, maybe that, you know, I like the idea that Andre, just the metaphor he gave of kind of, and maybe it was me, Andre, maybe I just thought it based on something you said, but I keep seeing turning a big ship around and how much effort it takes to turn that around, you know, and get it going in the right direction. And Michael saying, I've, you know, 2,000 years ago, I've come to make a beginning of setting these things straight. And the repercussions of the rebellion in this part of the universe, and how much time it takes to straighten out a problem. You know, that just we don't have a sense of repercussions on that level, on that magnitude. And so I think the angels of the future, they're in a holding pattern. That's what I get. They're in a holding pattern. They're waiting for the ship to be turned around. Once it's facing in the right direction, they're going to kick in big time. The angels of the races, I'm not really sure about that. Why that group would still be the first group, but it may be the same thing. I think the angels of superhuman ministry, their job is plum, as you said, Andre, because because angels ministering to angels, you know, it would be easier to minister to angels and other superhuman beings who are going to be
even the burnt out angels that you're talking about.
Well, maybe because their whole approach is going to be one of graciousness and dignity and lovingness. I mean, they're coming from a much better place than we humans. It's much harder to minister. It's like doing triage. I mean, you know, if you're going to go to a war zone and do triage, that's much more difficult than it is to go to the veterans' hospital and walk through and chat to the veterans that aren't feeling that bad right now at this moment, you know? I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, it's going to be easier for angels to minister to each other when they're all on the same page than it is for them to minister to us when we are in various levels of disarray and disaster.
Okay.
I find an interesting irony in all this. As we develop industrially, for example, therefore technologically, etc., our capacity to wage war is improved materially. In a literal sense, it's improved. And on the other hand, as we develop religiously or spiritually, we don't seem to go at the same pace. And I mentioned earlier in the 20th century, and this is continuing in the 21st century, we have the awful specter of totalitarianism, which took politics materially as far as it could be taken to be as oppressive and murderous as possible. We've had several manifestations, and we still have that going on. And that's the gulf between the material and the spiritual, I think, is in the extreme, is manifested negatively in totalitarianism. In a positive sense, it would be, say, to what Gandhi created out of whole cloth, the marriage of morality and politics, which he influenced others subsequently. But I was thinking of the paradise perspective, and I had never thought about this before. I was thinking about it this morning. One of my favorite teachings is the actions are ours and the consequences are God's. I was wondering how this applies here in terms of the rotation, the point of view of the master seraphim, how they view themselves, their role, their service, so forth. And then also how they interact with the spirit of truth and the spirit of truth with them. Because the timing, of course, was not coincidental. It was very deliberate. Had to have been deliberate. It was too spot on, 2.0. And I'm trying to be as coherent as I can. This is a process of thoughts unfinished. And I'm wondering if the primary supernatant bringing the paradise perspective is somehow has an influence by delegation of the consequences being God's. And in response to our actions, and hence the various rotations or lack of rotation, and that a paradise judgment perspective might make a judgment in terms of our progress or lack thereof, or something in between, that would speak to industrial and home-related and health-related and religious-related changes. On the one hand, and the other hand, the consequences of those, the paradise perspective may reflect. Because God is operating in all this. He's not absent. He's not an absentee father. He's very, very much involved. But he delegates. And I'm wondering if the use of a primary supernatant, and an additional benefit of a primary supernatant would be that delegation from paradise, from the paradise perspective. I'm not suggesting that it would come directly from the universal father through a primary supernatant. That I don't imagine. But there might be a reflection. She may be in direct touch, for all we know, with the infinite spirit.
Mm-hmm.
That's an absolute level of deity. I mean, there are possible... I would think in the assigning of... And we discuss other reasons why that there might be a primary supernatant, but that a rebellion, directly rebellion-related. But I think there may be other reasons that are of a more affirmative nature, a more progressive nature. And this, I'm just suggesting this may be a possibility.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. Clearly the loyalty aspect has got to be a big one. But it's not. Your points are well taken. Another aspect of a primary supernatant is that they don't just come in one flavor. Primary supernatant come in a variety of different flavors, and we have the directors of conduct, for one thing, directors of worship, masters of philosophy, custodians of knowledge, and we have the other two that I'm interpreters of ethics would be another one, and then the one that we wake up to, not the complement of rest, the other one, the instigator of rest, I believe. So the question is, clearly in this context, they're broad, wide, far-seeing beings. They're certainly well above, a particular stereotype. And not trying to cheapen that and say that that's a stereotype. Quite the opposite. It might be very interesting to consider just that the fact that we have our second primary supernatant may have something to do as well with changing from one phase where, for instance, knowledge was more important at one phase to perhaps ethics being more important at another phase, or conduct being more important, in the specific ways that those are treated in the paper that is talking about the primary supernatant. So that's just an idea that occurred to me as well as you were talking, Charles.
That's very insightful.
You know,
so you're interpreting the idea of rotation as embodying variety of mission or variety of emphasis. Is that what I understand correctly?
Well, again, the primary Supernafem, again, is not just, you know, coming in the flavor vanilla. We're getting those other seven aspects, and we know that the custodians of knowledge are a very different kind of Supernafem. I mean, when we go and visit custodians of knowledge as living libraries, it's one thing to visit a living library. It's quite another to visit a master of philosophy or a conductor of worship. I'm sure, and as is underscored by the fact that we're under the regime of each one, different kinds successively in our post-Havona pre-finaliter preparation for the core of the finality on paradise. So
I think these are all very interesting aspects. I would add to them that the chief of Seraphim, by nature of the functions, the word chief, has an executive position. She must be able to chair the 12 core, the directors of the 12 core, and establish a general process for the overall work of the 12 core of Master Seraphim taken together.
I just want to also share a quote that I think is pretty poignant to me. It's from paper 38. It is section 2, paragraph 1. Angels do not have material bodies, but they are definite and discrete beings. They are of spirit nature and origin, though invisible to mortals. They perceive you as you are in the flesh, without the aid of transformers or translators. They intellectually understand the mode of mortal life, and they share all of man's non-sensuous emotions and sentiments. They appreciate and greatly enjoy your efforts in music, art, and real humor. They are fully cognizant of your moral struggles and spiritual difficulties. They love human beings, and only good can result from your efforts to understand and love them. What really strikes me about that, and they say in another place, paper 113, they share most of your emotions and experience some additional ones, is this idea that they share these emotions and sentiments. And what it must be like then, and I say this only because I've had the experience of what I believe a moment and a couple of times in my life where I've actually cried with them, and I felt an emotion so intense that it was almost beyond description. And
all of these are very, very beautiful observations. I'm looking at the clock, and I'm wondering whether we have any more time left. We're coming very close.
Well, we're down to the last 2 minutes, so maybe you should go ahead and give us a quick idea of what we're going to be covering
before the
next
archive
week.
Portion.
Yeah, right.
Then, in effect, I'd just like to close for the purposes of our regular listeners with the identification. This has been the Cosmic Citizen radio program. We've been discussing the work of the Master Seraphim, which in turn correlates with Section 6 of Paper 114, specifically discussing a detailed study guide that is available for download at www.globalendeavor.net. And we have just concluded, I think, the discussion of question 5 in the study guide. We would then resume next week with discussion of question 6, which begins at near the bottom of page 5 of the study guide. So this is Neil Waldrop, who appreciates very much the opportunity to discuss these questions with all my colleagues, Paula, Andre, and Charles.
And thank you, Neil, and thank you, Andre and Charles, for your continued support of this endeavor. And also, we'll hopefully have Crystalline back next week to join us in this discussion again, and we hope you've enjoyed this discussion of the Master Seraphim and their unceasing campaign.
Bye for now, all.
And
bye.
Have a great week. Bye for now.
Yeah. So
are we off?
We are off the air. Yeah.
Although it said, never assume you're off. Many a politician has today.
So I think so Vice President Biden was caught with a comment to President Obama at the time of signing the health care law.
We won't repeat what he said, though.
No, we won't. But he was embarrassed. Well,
President Reagan once said,
I
think I'll bomb Russia. And the Russians, the Soviets took exception to that. And he said, oh, I'm just joking. He mentioned in the press conference. But it was heard.
Right. I am delighted with the discussion that we had today. I was surprised at how much poured forth from all of you. I thought it was a beautiful discussion.
I love the depth.
Yeah, likewise.
I love the depth and the scope.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you.
The depth.
You too.
The only reflection that I have is to wonder whether we will actually complete the 14 pages in the 4 weeks that I envisioned when we talked last week. But we'll simply have to keep going and see what it takes in terms of each question. I agree with a comment that Charles made several programs ago that we should not be in a hurry. The point is the quality of the ideas.
Well, just to add that just very briefly, there are at least three times in the book that study is highlighted and emphasized supremely in the context of the rancher life. And it's done in balance with service and prayer, worship. What we're doing is the nature of study, and it's the nature of the best kinds of studies to have an element of order and an element of creativity. And I think we have a good balance between structure. Your paper provides a structure or order, and we bring through thought our creativity to the interpretation of the text and the questions.
I agree with everything you just said, Charles. I would say, in addition, the fact that the participants, all four of us today, plus Crystalline, have diverse backgrounds contributes quite a bit, because we bring different experiences and we are able to draw on different insights that have emerged over the course of lives that have been influenced very much by reflections on spiritual matters.
Absolutely.
I should mention Paula and Andre as the hosts, as a courtesy to you, that Mary and I, my wife Mary and I, are going to go to Connecticut, leaving on June 19th. We're driving. We expect to arrive on the 22nd, which is a Saturday. So I will. If we have further discussion that day, I'll have to miss it because I'll be on the interstate, and I wouldn't drive. And the 29th, which is another Saturday of June, and then the July 6th, which is a Saturday, I will be in Connecticut, but hope I can borrow a phone to use it. I'm hopeful with that. And then we'll be back on the 10th of July and back home, because I use my landline ordinarily. I just want to let you know. So I won't be available on the 22nd of June. The others, I'm not sure about. Subsequently.
Okay.
As I mentioned last week, I will not be available on the first Saturday in July because I will be out of the country. But it now is a question as to whether we will finish before then by the 29th, and I'm just not sure based on the beautiful discussion we had today.
Well, that would put four programs still through June,
right.
Potentially, or three if Angie is coming on as a guest, and that's something that Crystalline talked about, and unfortunately, without Crystalline here, we don't know yet how that's gone in terms of whether Angie has scheduled to want to break in, and we had conflicting feelings about whether or not to do that, or whether we felt like we had an obligation to Angie or not. But that still remains an open question, and I'll try to remember to pose that to Crystal in this week and see whether or not that has been decided. Because if it hasn't, then my default position is that we keep going with this wonderful study. And just looking ahead, question six wraps up this particular part two on history since Pentecost. And then it looks like, you know, that it may be possible to make a start at 7 if our discussion goes, thoroughly through 6. It looks like you've broken it into three parts with a lot of quotation there. So the question is, how much discussion will happen around the questions that you have?
In both questions 6 and 7 have subparts and are quite complicated. It's very hard for me to predict how long the discussion will take because I was surprised today, and I am prepared to be surprised again.
Right. I am no longer surprised by this.
Yeah,
by
I was
this.
Just going to say that.
I'm never surprised. This tends to happen a lot with us, so...
Well, back to your question about the scheduling, Andre, I would simply like to make it clear that I am completely flexible, assuming that I am available. In other words, I believe that listeners who tune in to one program will benefit from it regardless of whether or not it connects with the previous week, and that we do not have to have an uninterrupted series. So if it is better to have the lady whom you mentioned conduct
yeah,
the
Angie
program.
Thurston. Right.
Yes. At some point, I would certainly not object to that. It is a matter for you and Paula and Crystal then to decide the sequence of events, and I'm at your disposition.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that so much.
But you're welcome. For next week, though, we would expect to continue from where we left off. I assume that's what Andre said earlier. Yes.
Yeah, and what I'll do is in the blurb, I will go ahead and put forward questions both from 6 and 7.
Good.
In anticipation of the fact that we may at least partially get through some of 7 and not expecting to.
I think that's a very reasonable approach.
Yeah, okay. Me too. And thanks for keeping the Global Endeavor posted, you know, where they can get the PDF document, Andre. That's really helpful, I think.
Who knows?
Mechanically,
how many people are doing that?
I got cut off at one point, and I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden the line went beep, 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 and I was off. And
yeah,
so I
that
redialed.
That happened to me, too, at the end.
Yeah, did it? I redialed, and Paula let me in, so I don't know if there's any other technique that is available under those conditions.
That's it. Paula is alive and awake at the switch, thank goodness. You know,
it's just the nature of some, you know, a blog talk. I'm not sure why that ever happens. I've been actually thrown out a couple of times and just prayed that the show didn't end because oftentimes the host calling is the one that, is the key. But and it didn't. It was still going on, and I was so thankful. When I called back in, I immediately called back in. So it's just the nature of blog talk. I don't know why that happens exactly. But it's, you know, a lot of times the Internet becomes unstable for one reason or another, and I think that's what it is. I don't really think I have any control over it. But I do try to keep a real close eye on the board and see. At one point we had a caller, but I didn't, take the call. Because I didn't get a chance. They hung up before I got a chance. They were holding for about 4 minutes and then hung up. So.
Okay.
Well, I was starting to have a sort of a fantasy that sometime or other in the discussion where I was not connected, Andre would say, "What do you think, Neil?" And he would say, "Neil, are you there or just not quite all there?"
Yeah, right.
We would have covered for you, Neil.
All right, yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. I don't know how we would have.
For sure.
I'm trying to make a joke, but I was rather worried at the time because of my responsibilities as the moderator for this particular discussion.
Well, you did a great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I'm delighted that this is working for all of us. So.
Yeah, me too.
It's a great joy.
My friend.
As well as
thank you.
Fruitful.
I just feel so honored to be in your company. So.
Well, it's a wonderful experience. And and Andre and Crystalline have created the opportunity for Charles and myself, and we appreciate it.
We do.
Thank you. Thank
you. Very much
appreciate it. God bless you all.
God bless you. Have a wonderful weekend, you guys.
Yes,
thank
you too. Okay, until next week then.
Until next
grace week. Grace is ever with you.
Yes,
likewise.
Adios. Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.